Well, this morning, I want to speak a message, and I'm going to call it a life-giving leader, a life-giving leader. And here's what I know is that everybody in this room is a leader. Whether you are paid by a church, whether you have a title, you are a leader because you are a woman and you have influence. And it's important that we as women recognize the influence that God has placed on our lives. Okay, my pastor's wife, she would always say that her pastor's wife would say that if the man is the head, then the woman is the neck that turns the head, right? And you know that it's true because you're a pastor's wife and what you say matters to your husband, it matters to your staff, it matters to your volunteers, it matters to your children. You are a woman of influence. You are a leader. And leadership really isn't a position. It doesn't come because of a title or because of a paycheck. Leadership is really an attitude, and it's moment by moment decisions of being willing. Yes, I will serve again. Yes, I will step up again. Yes, I will pray again. Yes, I will be full of faith again. It's a moment by moment decision to step into that gifting, that leadership, that obedience that God is asking of you in your family, in your ministry, at your work, wherever you're at. And we all know that there are all types of leaders, right? I've been in ministry for over 20 years between my leadership college years and then being on staff and many different roles. And I have seen bad leaders. I have seen mad leaders. I have seen angry leaders. I have seen great leaders. We have seen all types of leaders. Some people you learn and you go, I want to be like that. Some people you learn from because you go, I don't want to be like that, right? But we're all observing, we're all experiencing different type of leaders, but we know the best leader that ever walked the face of this earth was Jesus Christ. That one man came to this earth 2,000 years ago, and believers and unbelievers alike are still quoting him to this day, are still fascinated with him, are still following in his ways. And I love that the theme of this conference is first, or this retreat is first light. I love that picture of the first light and the light that's breaking through the darkness. And when I think about that, I think of a life-giving leader because someone who's life-giving is walking into rooms and lighting up the room. They're walking in, and when you are a life-giving leader, you are a breath of fresh air. Have you ever been around someone and you're like, oh, I just feel lighter after I had that conversation with them. I just feel better after I talked with them. You're a life-giving person. You're a breath of fresh air. If you are a life-giving leader, it means that you are consistent. No one's having to guess what version of you they're going to get each day. Are they happy today? Do they have coffee? Are they angry today? Are things going? I got to tiptoe around them because I'm not sure who I'm going to get. No, when you are someone that you are a life-giving leader, and everybody's a leader, you are consistent in who you are, and a lot of it comes back to what we talked about last night, the practicality of nourish to flourish. When your inputs are consistent, your output is consistent. And what a gift we can give to the church, to our families, to our spouse, when we are consistent in who we are. I can tell a difference if I haven't been having the right spiritual nourishment. I start to kind of get irritated and edgy and a little selfish. And like a week or so ago, I was like, I don't really like who I am right now. My inputs are not what they need to be, right? You can self-recognize when you don't have the right inputs, and it changes your output. And so we know that Jesus was the best leader. I want you to think about him. So many times when we see photos of Jesus or paintings, he looks like malnourished and he's holding the lamb. It just looks so sad. But then we read about him, and that's not the picture that the Bible paints at all, right? It says that kids flocked to him, that people loved him, that he was feasting at tables with people, relaxing, enjoying, speaking life, encouraging. That's who Jesus was. He was a life-giving leader, and we are called to be like him. And how did Jesus describe himself? As living water. He said, I am living water. He was kind, He was clear, he was consistent, and we know that water is essential for life. We kind of have an obsession with water in our culture, right? Like we have the trendiest containers to transport our water. It was a Yeti, then we're into Hydro Flasks, then we're into Stanleys, now we're into Owalas, like all of the things. I think about how every day before my kids go to school, I'm like, do you have your water bottle? And I'm like, when I went to school, my parents were like, bye. I had no water bottles. I had nothing. I had a drinking fountain. And even at that, I was remembering how we would line up for the drinking fountain and the teacher would count. They'd be like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Lisa, you're done. I was like, I'm still thirsty, right? Now it's like, you can have all the water you want whenever you want. My kids are so spoiled by the water they get. But we know that water's so important because when your water intake is up, right, your headaches are less. They go down. When your water intake is up, you are more energized. One of the leading causes for fatigue is dehydration. Water is refreshing in every sense of the way, not just practically, but spiritually. When there is a fresh water spring, I want you to picture it, like if you're in the mountains somewhere, there's a fresh body of water and it's flowing. It's like teeming with life. There's motion, there's movement, it's full of life. Opposed to a stagnant body of water, where it's like filled with bugs and it's muddy and sediment filled and you're like, I don't want to be near it. There's a great contrast between a body of water that is moving and is full of life opposed to one that is stagnant. And we want to be someone that is full of life. And life-giving people can be likened to a fountain. Proverbs actually talks about this. Proverbs 16:22 says, understanding is a fountain of life to the one who has it. Proverbs 13:14 says, the teaching of the wise is a fountain of life. Proverbs 10:11 says, the mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life. And I want you to think about fountains that are bringing forth water all over the world, right? People will travel around the world to see famous fountains. Like we think about the Trevi Fountain in Rome, and people travel there so they can just see it in person and throw a penny into the fountain. We think of the Buckingham Fountain in Chicago. Some of my friends got engaged there. It's like people travel just to be a part and to see this in real life. The Fountain des Mers in Paris is famous. People will go there just to see these fountains. People travel around the world to see fountains because they are bubbling with life. They are beautiful. They're teeming with new life. They're attractional. But when we compared earlier living water to stagnant water, what about if we compare the opposite of a fountain, right? What is the opposite of a fountain? It would be a drain. No one's traveling around the world to see a drain. Why? Because quite literally, drains suck. That is what they do. That is their function. Is that okay, Barb? That's literally what they do. Drains suck. That's what happens. And even now, as you're thinking about the contrast between a fountain and a drain, you might be thinking of people or things that kind of drain you. No, not us in ministry, not pastors' wives. But it's very real that there are people and there are things that drain you. And I want to encourage you, just something that, none of this is in my notes, but I was just thinking about, it's been helpful for me, is that maybe like a year ago, my husband and I, we just had a conversation and we were like, just confidentially between the two of us, and we were like, who are the people that drain us? And we just took some time to identify who those people are. Some of them could be on staff. Some of them could be in the church. Maybe they're a family member. And we just had a conversation, and we just talked about learning to identify who are life-giving people in our life, who are draining people, and to be strategic and to guard our time, that maybe if there's people who are draining, we're not going to give them a dinner slot in our life and take time away from our kids to be with people who suck the life out of us. maybe we're still going to invest, but you get a lunchtime slot while my kids are in school, right? And so we just want to be aware of people who drain us, who people who fill us, and that we're planning and we're being strategic accordingly. And of course, we don't want to be the drain. You know the people who are the drain. You like don't even want to ask them, hey, how are you? Because you're like, oh my gosh, they're going to tell me everything that went wrong in the last 2 hours, right? And there's people who can be so Eeyore-ish, but I think we're meant to be more Tigger than Eeyore as Christ followers, that we want to be people who are life-giving. And when we're life-giving, we walk into a room and we bring the light of Christ into our ministries, into our families, into our workplaces, our schools, wherever we're at. We're bringing the light and we're being life-giving leaders. We're ushering forward motion and we're ushering forward the life that God wants instead of being a drain that sucks the life out of our husbands, other people, our family members. And so this morning, I just want to give us 4 attributes of a life-giving leader. And then we're going to end with a story from the Bible that I believe is going to encourage us today. And so the first attribute of a life-giving leader is a life-giving leader thinks and speaks life. A life-giving leader thinks and speaks life. This is so important that we recognize this. Why is this important? Because you are the only one responsible for the thoughts that you think and for the words that you speak. Why are you the only one responsible for the thoughts that you think? You're the only one who knows the thoughts that you think. And I recently read that 60% of the dialogue that we'll have in our life happens internally. Some of you, it's even more. Your mind is on overdrive all the time, right? 60% is internal dialogue. And so we have to be careful, and I say this all the time, that we think about what we're thinking about. Think about what you're thinking about. Does it line up with Philippians 4:8? Is it good? Is it lovely? Is it pure? Is it praiseworthy? Is it good? Is it honoring? Or is it draining you? Is it giving into the lies of the enemy? Think about what you're thinking about. Why is this important? Proverbs 23:7 says, "For as he thinketh within himself, so is he." That is a powerful statement that we have to take seriously. It's God's word, it's truth. As he thinketh within himself, so is he. What we know is that thoughts form beliefs, beliefs form actions, and actions determine results. So when we're thinking about something, it forms a belief, that belief turns into an action, and then that leads us into having a result, whether we like it or not. And if you don't like the crop that you're reaping, check the seeds that you're sowing. If you're like, man, why do I always feel this way about myself? Well, what seeds are you sowing? What things are you listening to? What thoughts are you entertaining in your life? You know, I recently heard or I read a story that took place in your amazing state of Minnesota at a garage sale. Anybody like garage sales? Okay, we've got some garage salers. I get kind of stressed out by garage sales. One of my best friends is amazing at garage sales, so I give her all my stuff. And she sells it, and she keeps a lot of the money, but it's great. But I heard this story of this couple, and they had acquired this photo, this painting, and it was a painting that was very unique. And so they had had it for a while, and they always had this hunch. They thought, could this painting be worth something of value? And they had this hunch, they're like, could this be from the great art explosion that happened in the south of France in the late 1800s, early 1900s? Could this be a painting that maybe even, just maybe, Van Gogh did himself? So they took a picture of the painting and they sent it in to a famous art institute and they said, what do you think? Could this be a famous painting? Could this be of great value? So they got correspondence back, and the correspondent said, no, we don't think that this could be a Van Gogh. We don't think that this is a painting of value. And so they took that one opinion, and they believed it, and they went into action, and when garage sale time came, they sold that sucker in the garage sale for $50. Well, the guy who purchased the painting from them happened to be an art collector, and he thought, could this painting be of value? could this painting be a Van Gogh? So he took a photo of it and he sent it into an art institute, an art firm in New York City. And they reached back out to him and they said, we're very interested in this photo. And they ended up purchasing it from him for an undisclosed amount of money. So this art firm has spent the last, I think it's like 7 years, researching this one painting, analyzing the brush strokes, analyzing where the canvas is from. They found a hair in the painting, so gross, sent it in for like a DNA check. It was too old, but like they are in it. They created a 456-page document on their research. Their conclusion is that it is an original from Vincent Van Gogh. Okay, it's still pending, but that is their conclusion, 456 pages of research saying this. And if it is a Van Gogh, it is not worth $50. It is not worth $50,000. It is not worth $1 million. It will be worth $15 million. And I just think, I bet that couple wish they would have gotten a second opinion. And it just reminds me, what we think about really does determine what we believe. They said, yeah, you think it's not worth, I believe that, I'm going to sell this, and I'm going to base my actions on this one opinion. And how many times do we take the opinion that's not true, and we entertain it, and we think about it, somebody told you you're not good at that, you believed it, and you stopped doing it because of that one person's opinion. What you think about determines what you do. And so you have to be really careful what you allow in your mind and what you allow in your heart. And this is a side note to that story. What makes the Van Gogh painting valuable is not that it is from Minnesota or found in Minnesota. It's not the size of the canvas. It's not the color of the brush strokes. It's not because it looks a certain way. The only thing that makes that particular painting valuable is because of who painted it. And I just want to remind each and every one of you today, I want to look in your eyes like we are sitting across from each other at a table having coffee. And I want you to be encouraged today and remind you, you have value and God loves you, not because of what you look like, not because of what you do, not because of where you live or what church you serve at, but because the God of the universe created you and you are his masterpiece. He made you of great value. He loves you so greatly. And I want you to think about that, and I want you to believe it, and I want you to get it into your heart so that when you're living out your day-to-day, you're doing it from a place of knowing, I am loved, I am valued, God created me, I'm thinking about this, I believe it, and it determines my actions. God loves you. And if you're ever wondering, what am I thinking about? What is in my heart? What is in my mind? I want to encourage you to listen to the words that are coming out of your mouth. And it's a great indicator of what's in your mind and what's in your heart. What does the Bible say in Luke 6:45? Yeah, Luke 6:45, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Sometimes when I'm in groups and people are talking, I'm just listening because I'm going, I know what's in their heart by what's coming out of their mouth. I know what's in my heart by what's coming out of my mouth. I know if I'm irritated with my husband by what's coming out of my mouth. I know if I'm irritated with somebody on the team by what's coming out of my mouth. I have to be careful to pay attention not only to my thoughts but my words, because my words inform what's going on in my mind and what's going on in my heart. And this is so important because what's in you overflows out of you to those around you. Okay, so we know, we're talking, you're a leader, you've got influence. What's happening in you overflows to those around you. A saying that I think about frequently is that you will reduce the environment around you to match the environment within you. You will reduce the environment around you to match the environment within you. So if you are unhappy with yourself, you're going to be unhappy with everybody around you. If you are discontent internally, you will be discontent externally. If you are frustrated internally, you're going to be frustrated with everything happening externally. If you think little of yourself, you're going to belittle the people around you. You're going to match the environment around you, reduce the environment around you to match the environment within you. So when we talk about, man, what's going on in our heart, what's going on in our minds, you have to fight for that. It is hard work to think about what you're thinking about. You think of thousands, tens of thousands of thoughts every day. It takes discipline, but it's not just for your sake. It's for the people that God has entrusted you with. Your family, your husband, your kids, your friends, your sisters, your mama, whoever it might be. And so we have to be careful about what we're thinking and about what we're saying. Sometimes I say things before I even really believe them. I'm just speaking it into existence. I remember going through a season a while ago where I was like, everything is hard. Everyone's inconveniencing me. And one of my friends who's like so joyful, I just started to notice, we worked together. Whenever I asked her to do something, she's like, no problem, I'd love to. Happy to help. Thanks for asking me. Thanks for the opportunity. So glad that you trust me with this. Oh, it's my honor. It's a joy to serve. And I was like, oh my gosh, she's so joyful. And here I am being like, you need what from me, right? And so I was like, I'm going to pick up this vocabulary, even though I don't even believe it yet. So when someone's like, hey, can you do this? I'm like, I'd be happy to, you know? Thanks for asking me. And I just was like, I'm going to take the next month and I'm just going to focus on speaking what I want to be true. And what I found is as I was speaking life and as I was thinking life, I began to believe what I was saying. Yeah, it's no problem. And really, it isn't. Yeah, I can do that in no time. For sure, I'd love to get that done for you. I'll be happy to help with the solution. Thanks for asking me. I'm honored. It's a joy. And I started to believe that. And I started to see things shift in my mind and in my heart. So watch your vocabulary, because your vocabulary is going to create culture for you internally, in your ministry, in your home, externally. It's amazing the things that I just say that kind of are like our family culture, our family mission statements, our kids now say, because it's just an overflow. The second thing, that attribute of a life-giving leader, is that we are full of faith. We are full of faith, right? Hebrews 11:1. Now faith is a confidence in what we hope for and the assurance of what we do not yet see, right? It's that we're living by faith, not by sight. And it's so important that you see your family through the eyes of faith. It's so important that you see your ministry through the eyes of faith. I remember 19 years ago, we launched a women's conference, and there was 99 women there. We thought we were going to have 800. We tanked the budget. We were like, we should just quit with what we're doing. And our senior pastor was like, no, it's going to be full one day. Keep going. He had eyes of faith. And we just celebrated 19 years with thousands of women in attendance. Eyes of faith. He could see what we could not see. The same senior pastor, I've served under his leadership for almost 20 years, incredible pastors, Pastor Jeremy and Jen Dwert. And I remember in 2007, they took over as senior pastors of this church, and I was their first hire. I was like, you should have fired me, but they hired me, and I'm so grateful that they did. And in 2007, our church auditorium, okay, it was massive. When they built in the 80s, remember when they were building all of the huge auditoriums? They called it a table for 5,000. There was like 80 people in this room. That was so big. And everybody was cantankerous because it was just a transition. People were angry. People were hurt. And I remember Pastor Jeremy would get up on the stage and he'd be like, we're so glad you're at church today. You know, we're not just a friendly church. We're a family church. And he would come down and I would say, no one here is friendly. There's no families here. Everybody's old. And he was like, one day we will be a family church. One day we will be a friendly church. And we began to see what he could only see in the spirit come into reality. And I want to encourage you, don't just see things as they are. See things as they could be. For your family, for your friendships, for your ministry, for your life. Take some time while you're at this beautiful setting and close your eyes and say, God, help me to see past what I can see with my physical eyes and help me to be able to see in the spirit realm what this could look like. Let God give you a fresh vision for your family. Let God give you a fresh vision for the ministry that he's entrusted to you. See with eyes of faith and then start to speak what you see. Tell somebody about it. Don't just keep it to yourself. Hey, I know we're doing this and we're at 100 and I see by next year we're going to increase by, like, speak it into existence. Start to create the culture with your words from what God is showing you in the spirit. He has so much for each and every one of us. You know, my youngest son, Ryder, when he was born, he was a big kid. He was almost 9 pounds and had a smooth pregnancy. Everything was well. And then when he was born with really swollen feet. And I thought, well, these are the cutest, chubbiest feet I have ever seen in my life. And the doctor came in. He was probably an hour out of the womb, okay? He's fresh from heaven. And the doctor came in. He was like, these feet are indicators. They're so swollen of one or two diseases. And I remember my husband and I were just floored. And we thought, a disease? Like, what do you mean? And so he explained to us it could be one of two different diseases, one terminal, one incurable. I remember calling you guys, Carrie's here, her and her husband are an amazing part of our team at City First, and her husband's on the church board, and they were on a board retreat, and Adam called them and said, can everybody be praying? We don't know what's going on. We were just shocked. And so we went through a series of tests, 9 months of testing before they could conclude what was going on. So 9 months, I also had a one-year-old at this time, it was wild, and getting like heart tests, organs tested, and eventually they diagnosed Ryder with something called Milroy disease, which is a form of lymphedema. It just means he has isolated swelling from below the knees down. Really rare, it's genetic, so he could pass it on. We don't have it, it was like a mutation that happened, and we were so worried. When he was a baby, I was like, will he ever be able to walk? Will his life ever be normal? We had so much worry. And my husband, we wrote on this like chalkboard in our kitchen, we walk by faith, not by sight, and we're going to speak life over this child. And so after we finally found a specialist, and as Ryder grew, they were like, Ryder's case is really mild. He has swollen feet. Sometimes he's in pain, but he's going to live a normal life. He's going to have normal mobility. And it's so true. Like, he will chase you down and Hulk smash you. He is a tough kid. And so now he just turned 8 years old. And so it's not as severe as I thought it could be, praise God. The doctor was like, you guys are blessed with a really mild case. His feet hurt. He sleeps with compression boots, and his feet are really, they're chunky, they're fat. And so the other day I was driving with the kids, and all throughout these 8 years, we just speak life over Ryder. We're like, Rye, you're good. God's given you so much, and you're healthy, and you've got both of your feet and your legs, and you can run and play sports. We just speak life. We don't deny what's going on. We have medical help, but we just speak life. And so the other day we were driving in the car, and we were talking about Milroy disease, and my oldest was like, yeah, that just means, you know, Ryder's got fat, he's got chubby feet. And Ryder was like, I like my fat feet. I like my chubby feet. He's like, I think they're awesome. They're very strong. I was like, yeah, that's right, buddy. Like, if he stomps on your foot with his foot, it hurts. And so I just was like, I unintentionally, just by speaking life, I wasn't thinking, oh, he's listening to everything that I'm saying, but he's listening, and it shaped his perspective, and it shaped his faith, and there's so much power in our words, and power in our perspective, and power in what we speak over our family. So I just want to encourage you to speak life, to be full of faith, and to be somebody who's going to encourage those around them and help create the culture, because we know as women, we are culture setters. In my family, if I set a table of food out, everybody in my family is there in like 5 seconds, and they are eating what I have fed them. That happens in the physical. It also happens in the spiritual. When you set a table of faith, your family is going to consume faith. When you set a table that is speaking life, your family is going to consume life. When you set a table of encouragement, the people around you are going to be encouraged. People are going to react and respond to the table that you are setting. And as women, we love to set a beautiful table, but we have to be thinking about what kind of table are we setting, not just in the physical, but in the spiritual as well. So let's be people who set a table that's going to nourish other people, speak life over them. And so I want to end with a story from Mark chapter 6. And I've never preached this before, but as I was praying for you guys, this is a story that kept coming back to mind. And so I want to be obedient to read this to you today. And this is in the New Testament, Mark chapter 6, and this is about John the Baptist. Okay, we know that John the Baptist was beheaded, right? That's how he was killed. It talks about how Jesus was mourning the loss of John the Baptist. But the circumstances surrounding the beheading of John the Baptist are so interesting. And I want to read this story that is about John the Baptist and how this took place. And so we're going to have the verses on the screen, but I'm also going to read them for you out of here, okay? So it says, "For Herod himself had given orders to have John the Baptist arrested, and he had him bound and put in prison. He did this because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, whom he had married." Okay, so we have some family drama going on. Herod's mistress was a sister-in-law, okay? He took his brother's wife. John had been saying to Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." So Herodias nursed a grudge against John and wanted to kill him. Can everybody say nursed a grudge? She wasn't just upset. She wasn't just mad. She nursed a grudge, which means that she was dwelling on the things that happened. You've nursed a grudge before, so have I, where you're having imaginary conversations with that person while you're driving. You're dwelling. Well, if I would have just said this, my best comebacks come at 2 a.m. while I'm by myself, right? And if I would have just said this, and if they would have just, and if this would have, and you're dwelling, and you're meditating on it. And every time that person that offends you, you see them, you're more irritated with them. You're criticizing everything that they do. When you're doing these things, we're nursing a grudge. And Herodias nursed a grudge against John, and she wanted to kill him. But she was not able to because Herod feared John the Baptist, and he protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. When Herod heard John, he was greatly puzzled, yet he liked to listen to him, because eternity is set in the hearts of all men. Finally, the opportune time came. Can I just tell you, you will always have an opportunity to do what is wrong. It will always come. You will always have an opportunity to just tell that person how you feel. The opportune time came. On his birthday, Herod, who's royalty, gave a banquet for his high officials and military commanders and the leading men of Galilee. When the daughter of Herodias came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his dinner guests. The king said to the girl, "Ask me for anything you want, and I will give it to you." And he promised her with an oath, "Whatever you ask, I will give you, up to half of my kingdom." His kingdom was massive. His riches were vast. His kingdom was glorious. And he said, "I will give you anything you want. Up to half of the kingdom could be yours." And he promised, okay, so when she went out after he promised this, and she said to her mother, "What shall I ask for?" "The head of John the Baptist," she answered. At once the girl hurried into the king with the request, "I want you to give me right now the head of John the Baptist on a platter." The king was greatly distressed, but because of his oaths and his dinner guests, he did not want to refuse her. So he immediately set an executioner with orders to bring John's head. The man went, beheaded John in the prison, and brought back his head on a platter. He presented it to the girl, and she gave it to her mother. On hearing this, John's disciples came and took his body and laid it in a tomb. Did the daughter have a grudge against John the Baptist? Who had the grudge? The mother. But the grudge didn't stay with the mother. It overflowed to the daughter. And now the daughter is in this generational dysfunction. And when she's given the opportunity to have the head of a dead man or up to half the kingdom, because her mother nursed a grudge, she chose a head instead of choosing half of the kingdom. And we are always going to have plenty of opportunity to be offended. We are always going to have plenty of opportunity to be full of negativity. We are always going to have plenty of opportunity to speak death instead of life. But when we do that, we are getting into this lower level of thinking, this lower level of leading, this lower level of living. And when you are thinking, should I nurse a grudge? Should I be offended? Should I be upset? What you're really saying is, do I want a head or half the kingdom? God has so much more for you. And when we nurse a grudge, we give in to playing small. We give in to living small. But when we say, God, I surrender this grudge to you. I surrender this bitterness. Some of you have been hurt by people. And you're in here today and you've been nursing a grudge. I forgot to give you the two other points out of the 4 points of a life-giving leader, the attributes. It was you're not easily offended and you steward your influence that God has given you. People will offend you. It's going to happen. We should not be surprised when people offend us. It's really just, God, who's going to offend me today? Like, it's going to happen. We're with people. People. But if we're ready for it, then we just go, I'm not going to take this offense and plant it in my heart and nurse it to a place of a grudge and of bitterness, because when I do that, I am choosing a lower level of thinking, living. And here's the thing, your grudge that you're nursing doesn't just affect you, it does affect your husband. And it does affect ministry. And it does affect your children. And it does affect those around you. I've been in ministry long enough and I've seen a lot of men in ministry leave. And whenever that happens and I'm thinking this doesn't make sense, a lot of times it's not because they were disgruntled, it's because their wives were disgruntled. The biggest influence you're going to have is in your marriage. How are you going to steward that? Are you going to speak life? Are you going to be an encourager? Are you going to say, oh, well, but we're not easily offended and create that culture? Or are you going to nurse the grudge? Say, yeah, I agree. That person does this and this person does that. Some of you, you got to give honor where honor is due, and it's hard for you to get it out of your lips because your heart has gotten hard. You got to get back to a place of saying, God, I honor you. I honor my leaders. I honor my staff. Respect is earned, honor is freely given. And when you honor someone, you're saying, God, take some of what's on their life and put it on mine. But when you withhold that honor, you're limiting what God can do in you, what God can do through you, what God can do in your life. And today I just felt like maybe some of you in this room have been nursing a grudge. You've been letting bitterness grow down deep in your heart. Maybe you've just been nursing a mindset that is not life-giving. Maybe your grudge is against your spouse. Maybe it's against somebody in the room. I don't know. But what I feel like I am here to do this morning is to say, would you lift your perspective? Would you stop playing small? Would you stop giving into the petty things, the petty conversations? And would you remember that there is a lost world who is in desperate need of Jesus? They need your heart to be soft. They need your light to be bright, because people are looking for Jesus, and you are the one that God wants to use to work and to do amazing things in your ministry, in your home, in your neighborhood, in your communities. And the enemy would love for you to be too preoccupied with bitterness and with grudges and with comparison and with insecurity so that you miss out on what God has for you, and the people who are meant to be reached by you are left unreached. Eternity is in the stakes. We just think, oh, I'm just mad. No, there's so much more to it. I want to invite you to stand all across this room. I want to be honoring of our time.